This is the 2009 Rogue River Bible School, Day 5. Our first period speaker is Brother Ken Stiles. His class subject has been the studies in Esther, and his class title for today is A Remarkable 24 Hours. Brother Ken.
Good morning, everyone. If you're a little sleepy and you need to stand up and stretch, it won't distract me at all, so feel welcome to do so. It's been quite enjoyable for Sister Diane and I to be with you this week, and very much appreciate the privilege of spending the week together with you. We left off our studies yesterday, having seen how Esther changed her mind in chapter 4 about who she served and how she served and what she should be doing, and it changed her life. She was willing to lay down her life for her people and go before the king. She does so and has the golden scepter extended to her. And we noted that most women in her position would have been overwhelmed by the enormity and the lavishness of the lifestyle of the queen. Most women would lose touch with spiritual reality in a circumstance like that, but not with Esther, because her circumstances did not change her character. It hadn't changed during the year of preparation, and it hadn't changed during the 5 years she's been on the throne. And chapter 4 also revealed to us that there was a young sister being led to the cross by her father. And she willingly embraced the principles of the cross. She willingly chose it, and she went out and lived it. It's one thing for a 90-year-old man to instruct a young sister about what the gospel of Christ calls us to. It's quite another thing for the 25-year-old sister to then go out and to live that doctrine. But that's what she did, willing to give up all for the sake of her people. And she stands, therefore, alongside the faithful men like Joseph and David, and Josiah and Daniel, and the other young people who early on had set their course to serve their God. Esther has a planned course of events in chapter 5. We're going to have to move fairly quickly today. We won't quite get through the entire book, but it's important to recognize that there's a change that occurs in chapter 4. Because Esther now is willing to stand up to Haman and watch the events unfold over the course of the next 24 hours when we come to that point. This is what God is able to do in the lives of people who determine in their heart that they will stand up to that wicked man Haman, or that Haman-like influence in their life. We can read the events of chapter 5 and wrongly conclude that somehow Esther is just feeling her way along. Didn't quite have a good feeling at the first banquet, so said, well, maybe I need a second banquet, and we'll see what happens then. That is not what's happening in these events, brothers and sisters. Esther is proceeding by faith and by spiritual wisdom and what she has learned in reading her Old Testament. She is not proceeding by feeling. It's not her feelings that are directing her steps. She doesn't ask for the first banquet when asked by the king, what is thy request, because she didn't have a good feeling about the situation. Notice in verse 4, she had already set in motion preparations for the first banquet before she went in to see the king, not knowing whether or not she would be extended the royal scepter. In verse 4 of chapter 5, and Esther said, if it please the king, or if it seem good to the king, let the king and Haman come this day to a dinner or a banquet that I have prepared for the king. She's talking past tense. I've already set in motion a banquet for this evening that I would like you and Haman to come to. She had no intention that morning to ask the king for the salvation of her people, because that would wait. But she had put in motion preparations for a banquet. She has a course of action she is following, and we will see that this course of action depends entirely upon the grace of God, because she is walking by faith, and she undertakes her course of action by faith. She is acting purposefully in these chapters. It has been well thought out, but it absolutely requires God to intervene. Recall Mordecai's counsel in chapter 4. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? He had encouraged her to act by faith because he couldn't guarantee her anything. And now she does. And the proof that she is acting by faith is that the course of action she undertakes absolutely requires God to intervene in the situation. It will not be Esther that brings down Haman. It will not be Mordecai that brings down Haman. It will be God orchestrating the events using people of faith who have committed to risking their lives to the death and destruction of Haman. God will use the lives of those people, and he will use the contribution of this one and this one and this one and bring them all together, and he will bring about the result which none of the individuals working independently would have been able to achieve. And this is exactly how God works in our life. She plans two banquets, and the two banquets are identical. You couldn't tell them apart. But between those two banquets, she purposely includes room, space for God to work in her plan, and God does. And he will do so, as we'll see, through precise timing of events over which she has absolutely no control, but which are vital to the right outcome. The events of chapter 5 and 6 are either all by chance, or we have a very faithful young sister risking her life, proceeding by faith, and God intervening at the exact moment needed to bring about the desired result. It's one or the other. And watch how the record reveals the hand of God at work. Her course of action begins with a three-day fast involving all the community in Shushan. On the third day of the fast, she would appear before the king and hope to find grace and have her life spared. If her life is preserved, the first banquet will take place that evening. Her sole aim at the first banquet was to again find grace and favor in the eyes of the king and invite he and Haman to a second banquet. So she is putting, as we say, space between these two banquets. She is not going to force the issue. At the conclusion of the 3 days of fasting, at the culmination of the community in Shushan, appealing to God through their fasting and prayers, Esther will then make her request known to the king, but not before. The first banquet happens while the fasting is still taking place. The second banquet will take place at the culmination of that fasting. And this charge that she will level against Haman at the second banquet will be a charge of treason, that he is an enemy not only of the Jews, but of the king, that he has acted in a way that is not consistent with the values of the empire. And remember, treason is acting against the best interests of the king or the empire, or trying to kill or put to death one of the members of the royal family. It's not going to be an easy charge. Haman has the absolute confidence of Ahasuerus. He wears the king's ring, we know in chapter 8, verse 2. The king has entrusted to him the running of the government. Politically, militarily, governmentally, social, no one is closer to the king than Haman. So to accuse Haman of treason will not come easy, and to challenge his loyalty will not be an easy situation for her. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on why there are two banquets. All we can do is point you in the direction of what we have found to be helpful. But a big piece of it has to do with a comment that Mordecai makes back in chapter 4. We draw your attention to section 43 in the notes. Remember when Mordecai explained to Esther, and he spoke of the need through the messenger of enlargement and deliverance. And you look at that word enlargement, and the Hebrew means a breathing space. It's ravak. The word means room or space. If you look in the AV margin, it's respiration. Mordecai was saying we need to give God room to work in this situation. The only other time it's translated in the Old Testament is back in Genesis chapter 32, when Jacob put space between the gifts that he was offering to Esau. And we've provided for you in the notes several identical parallels between what Jacob did that day and what Esther will do with the two banquets. In some cases, you will find identical word connections between the incidents. But the suggestion is that Esther, having heard her father speak of the need for enlargement and deliverance, took her mind back to the situation at Peniel, when Jacob was in need of deliverance from his enemy, who had 400 men that were on their way to destroy his family. And Jacob prays back in chapter 32 that God would intervene to save the family. And Brother Jim took us through the events of that chapter and the wrestling with the angel. And when he comes to the events of the next day, Jacob is overwhelmed to see that God has rendered the enemy powerless. And it's on that basis that the name of Israel is born. And the suggestion is that all of God's faithful children need to come to that point of understanding in their life. And that is how we enter into that name of Israel. When we come to recognize that the Esaus of the world, that the Hamans of the world can only be overcome by one basis. And that basis is our committing ourselves by faith to God and obeying him regardless of what the circumstances will require in our life. He will then intervene and overcome the power that has the ability to destroy us and save us from that power. It takes our whole heart, all of our soul, our mind, and our strength in doing so. But make no mistake about it, it was to the glory of Yahweh that the power of Esau was overcome in chapter 32 of Genesis, and it is to the glory of Yahweh that the man Haman and all of his wicked influence was overcome in the book of Esther. Just one note in Jeremiah 31, verses 8 and 9, we won't take the time to look there. But not surprisingly, when the Jews come back out of the north country in the second, at the time of the second coming, they will come following the exact same model of Genesis 32. They will come with weeping and supplication, the identical two words that we saw in Hosea 12 in the exhortation on Sunday night. So those faithful at the time of the end among the natural Israel will follow the same course and the same path that Jacob followed in Genesis 32, and they will learn the same lessons that Jacob learned as recorded in Hosea 12. And what God is showing us and teaching us is that there is only one way to break sin's hold over us and to develop a saving faith, and that it is critically important that we understand how he works in our life so that when he brings these trials into our life, as he brought Esau into the life of Jacob, as he brought Haman into the life of the Jews in Esther's day, we won't be confused by it. We will understand he is doing this to bring about our salvation. Esther doesn't ask for a second banquet because she has concluded the time isn't right in the first banquet. She is waiting upon God. She will leave room or space for God to work. She isn't going to try and do this all herself. Twice the king has said, I will give you up to half of the kingdom. And she doesn't take advantage of that offer because she will not try and bring Haman down in her own power and based upon her own appeal. The events now will show us how God works with our faith. Because she waits between the first and second banquet, chapter 6 happens. Chapter 5 records the first banquet. Chapter 7 records the second banquet. So the events of chapter 6 occur because Esther waits upon God. And she doesn't jump at the first opportunity of the king when he says, what is it, Esther? Even up to half of my kingdom I will give to you. Chapter 6 is the key to Haman's downfall. He left the first banquet, as we know, boasting like the obnoxious braggart that he was. He enters the second banquet in terrible sorts. his own people having warned him he will fall to Mordecai and the Jews, so that when Esther will lay her charge of treason, he will be terrified and come apart at the seams, both literally and figuratively. And this wouldn't have happened had Esther made her appeal to the king in the first banquet. And recognize that when we walk by faith, we have absolutely no control over the events that take place in our life. Esther has no control over the events of chapter 6. She can't control Haman's actions after the first banquet. She can't control the fact that he goes home to his wife and his friends, and he will now build a gallows to seek to Mordecai's life. She can't control the insomnia that comes upon the king, or the fact that Haman will visit the king at the very moment the king seeks to honor Mordecai. She didn't try to do it all. She couldn't do it all. When we walk by faith, we can't do it all, as we know. But she did what she could. Mordecai did what he could. The community did what it could. And they left the rest to God. The community in Shushan has been fasting and praying for 3 days. Mordecai has returned to the king's gate to continue his opposition to Haman. God will use, as we know, Mordecai's faithful and loyal actions back in chapter 2, a seemingly insignificant detail, to further precipitate Haman's downfall. Further proof that God is in control of all these events. He uses the individual pieces of the members of the ecclesia, the individual pieces of faithful obedience to accomplish his will. And he does it in such a way that when the events are done, none look back and can take any personal credit for the great things that God has able to accomplish. Notice, too, that following the first banquet, she's not out of the hot water. She's gone from one trial right into the next. She woke up the morning of the day when she appeared before the king, not knowing if she would survive. And she goes before the king, and she has the royal scepter extended to her. She goes to bed that night, knowing, if she went to bed that night, the next day she has to appear before the king and charge the prime minister with treason. Which would be more difficult? To stand before the king in the glory and the beauty of the empire and ask for him to extend his favor towards you when you know all along, since your relationship began, he has always shown you grace and favor? Or would it be more difficult in the king's presence to charge the prime minister with treason? In many ways, charging the prime minister with treason, I think, would be more difficult. But because she was faithful at the end of chapter 4 and agreed to go before the king and face that trial, she now has the privilege of the next day charging the prime minister with treason in the presence of the king. So do you see how her faith is being developed by God? Because of her faith in chapter 4, she's presented with a trial at the beginning of chapter 5. And because she faithfully obeys in that trial at the beginning of chapter 5, she will have an even greater trial at the end of chapter 5. And that is charging the prime minister with treason. So as her faith is growing, her trials are increasing. And in her case, the trials are coming one after another. She doesn't go to bed that first night and say, "Wow, I survived the presence of the king, I got through the first banquet, and we're on easy street." The decree still is there. The charge of treason still needs to be made. But we need to teach our young people, as we have come to see in our own lives, that as our faith increases, our trials will increase. Trials aren't something we endure and then have this long period of time where we don't have another one. God is heaping trials upon Esther in this situation. And he's doing it not out of punishment in any way or chastening. It's because this young woman, who was taking her counsel from Mordecai in chapter 4 and willingly committed her life, laying down her life for her people, is now taking her counsel from God himself. And it is God who is working in the events of Esther's life, directly with her, bringing her along the path of faith. To see the power of prayer at work in this book. Again, I realize the word never appears, But is there any doubt what Esther did when she went home that night? Banquet 2 comes up tomorrow night. The charge of treason will be leveled against the prime minister tomorrow night. I doubt she slept. Not because she was panicked, but because this had been, the events had come to a very momentous point. She would again seek God's intervention, only this time on behalf of her appeal to the king against Haman. God had spared her life that morning, and no doubt the night before she went in to see the king, she slept very little and prayed earnestly. That night, she is faced with the prospect of going before the king again. And this is where we need to picture the scene. I like to write the letters PTS in places in my Bible just to remind myself, picture what's happening in Shushan. Because there is concurrent activity taking place in three areas of Shushan. There is Esther in her chamber praying to God by faith for his help and intervention. Where is the king? The king is in his chamber. Only he has a problem. What is his problem? He can't sleep. She's praying for God's intervention, and he can't sleep in his chamber. Her prayer is being answered as she's offering it. And where is Haman? Haman is back home, gloating over all his accomplishments and calling for a 75-foot-high cross, as it were, gallows, to be erected for Mordecai to be put to death. That's what's happening, brethren and sisters, in chapter 6. Now, I realize it doesn't say Esther went home to pray, but you don't have to even use your imagination. It's still in the process of the three-day fast of the brethren and sisters, the believers, as it were, in Shushan. God is responding to the prayers of Esther. He's responding to the prayers of the community. This is not all just happening by chance. We must never underestimate the power of prayer in our life. It's how God works with us. So Esther went home that night after the first banquet to pray. Haman went home to boast, a further insight into his character. Remember, God uses Haman in this story to teach us about sin and what each of us are like by our nature. The egotistical preoccupation with ourself, seeing the world only through our own achievements. In verse 9 of chapter 5, he is at the top of the world. He went out that day joyful and glad of heart. And the word joyful is gleeful. He was full of glee over what he had been able to accomplish. And then he sees Mordecai at the gate, and his disposition changes immediately. And he is filled, it says, with indignation. He had been oh so proud of himself, and then he sees Mordecai. You see, men and women of the flesh allow their character to change according to the circumstances, but not men and women of the spirit. He goes home and he calls his wife and friends together for the purpose of reviewing his greatness. Verse 11, we've looked at it once already. He recounted to them, or told them, of the splendor, of his riches. And as Brother Robbie pointed out to me, notice the six indications of his and him. His riches, his sons, his promotions with which the king honored him, and how he advanced him above the princes and the servants of the king. The word told there means to recount. He goes through a checklist of all his accomplishments. I'd like you to all come to our cabin tonight because we're going to have a party. And the subject of the party is me. And we're going to talk about all the great things I have done, and I get to go first. That's who he is. That's what he is. And he's filled with indignation. And Zeresh steps forward. And instead of responding with, Haman, you are so full of yourself, you make me sick. She adds fuel to the fire. It's critical, sisters. When your husbands are in these kinds of situations, that you bring an Abigail-type spirit to the situation, because you can pour fuel on the fire in the way she did. So the gallows are built for Mordecai's execution. This would likely be a crucifixion, not a hanging, because the Persians were not accustomed to hanging individuals. In fact, if you just trace through the word, the Hebrew word for hang means suspend. The gallows means tree. If you look in the Septuagint in Acts 5, verse 30, and Acts 10, verse 39, you find the same Greek word applied to the cross of Christ as we see used in the Septuagint in these events. It's billed as 75 feet high. This is going to be a public execution. Mordecai is going to be portrayed as a criminal to shame him and to discredit him as a worthless man fit only for public ridicule. And the parallels with the Lord Jesus Christ and the Haman-like egotism that the religious leaders of his day manifested become self-evident. But we'll leave that for your own consideration. What we want to focus on is the next 24 hours. And we don't want to miss the hand of God at work in these events. The prime minister has already scheduled Mordecai's execution for the next day. All he needs is the king's permission. And that very night, it just so happens that the king can't sleep. And if you look in the margin of the authorized version, it says that his sleep was driven away from him. His sleep fled. And it just so happens that he calls for the Chronicles to be read. And it just so happens that in reviewing the Chronicles, they come across an incident from 5 years earlier involving Mordecai having saved the king's life. And it just so happens that he inquires what reward was given to faithful Mordecai, and he learns that nothing was ever done for the man who saved your life. And the king just so happens to decide, well, if nothing has been done to honor him, then today will be the day that we honor this man for having saved my life. And it just so happens at that very moment that Haman walks into the king's court. And the king asks, Haman, what should we do to the man in whom the king delights to honor? Without revealing the identity of the man. And Haman, with all his egotism, concludes, who else would you want to honor but me? And it just so happens that the king then tells Haman that it won't be he that is to be honored, but Mordecai the Jew. So Haman had come to the king's court that day seeking Mordecai's death, and he leaves charged with the responsibility to honor and publicly extol the wonder and the loyal service of Mordecai. The fingerprints of God are all over these events if we have the eye of faith and we can see it. He doesn't leave his people alone in the midst of their trials when they have committed themselves to serving him. By prayer and fasting and mourning and acknowledging their sins and chastening their souls and seeking his intervention. And we need to see the hand of God at work in the faithful lives of these people so we can believe and can see the hand of God at work in our life. When we are faced with the Haman-like trials that others may have no idea exist in our life, but we turn to him in prayer, pleading with him to intervene to save us in the same way that we see him saving his people back in the days of Esther, so that we can learn to trust him as Esther and Mordecai came to trust him even in the darkest moments, believing that he is at work behind the scenes. The king desires to honor Mordecai. Five times the word is used in verses 6 to 9. highlighting how the king's mind is now focused on this single objective of honoring the man in whom the king delighteth to honor. In chapter 2 at verse 14, he delighted in Esther because of her character. And now in chapter 6, he is delighting in Mordecai's character. Both men, both the man and the woman, Esther and Mordecai, living by the same principles. In verse 3, when it talks about honor and dignity, it's the same two words that we saw back in chapter 1 at verse 4. You see, what Mordecai, what the king is doing, is he is not going to just give Mordecai a key to the city and say, well, let's see, today's August 28th or whatever the day is, let's honor him because I've got room in my schedule to do so. The king is going to take Mordecai and take the emblems and the symbols of the empire and wrap them around Mordecai and then have him paraded around the city because he wants all to see this man's character. And his faithful, loyal service to the throne is what we are honoring today. And we want all Persian citizens to take this man as their example. That's the purpose of taking Mordecai and clothing him in the royal robes and putting him on the royal horse with the royal crown and marching him around the city. Wonderful how God is working out these events. Mordecai was a model citizen. And we can see the contrast in the king's high regard for Mordecai and Haman's total disregard of him. Haman has a 75-foot high gallows built to publicly shame him as a criminal, and the king orders a one-man royal parade so that all will see this is the man in whom the king delights to honor. Haman's problem was that he didn't use character or right conduct to make his decisions. And again, the parallels between Christ and sin. So long as Christ remained sinless, sin had no independent power over him. Sin could do nothing to Christ eternally. It could bring about his death, but it couldn't keep him in the grave. The king examines the record and finds that Mordecai is not guilty of sin or treason, but he is worthy to be praised and to be honored, just as when the Lord God examined the record of Christ's life and found him to be worthy of praise and honor. Well, Haman walks in and hears the king's request and immediately concludes, "The king must be thinking about me." Exactly how the flesh tends to think. And when the king tells Haman that it will be Mordecai that we are to honor, it likely hit Haman as a ton of bricks, because not only was he not to be the one to be honored, and not only will he not walk out with the king's approval to put Mordecai to death, but he will now be the one appointed to bestow the honor, the royal honor, upon Mordecai, according to the king's command, down to the very last detail provided by Haman himself. You couldn't have designed a worse scenario for Haman. He entered the king's court that morning so convinced that he had it all, and he walks out devastated. But God had purposely rendered Haman powerless before Mordecai, just as sin would be rendered powerless before Christ. "Let him array him," Haman said. So Haman would dress Mordecai in the royal robes. "Let him conduct him," as the New King James has. So Haman would parade him through the city square. "And let him proclaim before him." And what we're being shown here is that sin will be brought down before the Lord Jesus Christ on the virtue of the same principles. In verse 11 of chapter 6, Mordecai will be taken back to the exact same spot that he had been 4 days earlier, back to the open square of the city. Now, I know in the AV it reads the word street, but he's going back to the exact same spot that 4 days earlier he had been weeping and wailing to get Esther's attention. Only this time he is not weeping and wailing, he is being paraded before all to see. He is now being elevated and glorified. And if we can get a hold of that picture, brethren and sisters, and believe it with all our heart, then we can come to see sin in our life and how Mordecai saw Haman's decree. It was one that you wail over and you plead with God to intervene to save us, and we have the assurance that God will intervene to save us. And he will deliver us from that power, and he will array us in a royal garment, and he will elevate us, and he will glorify us in the name of the Lord God. But it only comes in Mordecai's life because he bewailed that decree of Haman. And now he is glorified before him. Don't overlook the impact of the one-man parade on the Jewish community in Shushan. The public honoring of Mordecai that day would have brought tremendous hope and encouragement. You have been fasting and praying for 3 days. And now you arise on the fourth day, and lo and behold, Haman is parading Mordecai around the city, proclaiming him to be the one in whom the king delights to honor. There is no doubt in the minds of the community in Shushan that God has been at work in this situation. Mordecai is now recognized as an imperial hero in the eyes of the king. And one of the greatest unrecorded scenes in Scripture, you won't find it in chapter 6, but again, you don't have to use your imagination, is when word came to Esther. Either she opened the doors of her chamber and looked outside to see what was happening, or there was a knock on the door. And the news came that the king has decreed that this will be a special day in Shushan. Mordecai is to be made an imperial hero, and he is being paraded around the city as a model citizen by Haman. How do you think Esther would have responded to that news? Do you think for a moment she doubted that God was at work in this situation? She hasn't asked the king for anything. And before she will walk into the second banquet, the issue is over. The king says, that man is a hero. Haman says that man should be put to death. It's wonderful to see how God is at work in these events. Her faith is confirmed that morning. God's principles, God's ways are not some set of cold facts to be studied and analyzed. They are principles to be lived. Esther didn't just know about faith. She put her faith on the line. She stood up to that man. She was willing to risk her life, and she did what she could, even though it was not much by the world's standards. But God takes that spirit of Esther, and he is able to accomplish great things. And brethren and sisters, we need to bring the principles of God to work in our life. And we need to make them live in our life, as Esther did. God will purposely put us in situations which will encourage us to put the principles we learn into practice. Don't be surprised this week if God works in your life in any way the same that he works in my life. That the things that you have learned this week, he will test you on in the days ahead. If you have examined your relationship with your spouse or your contribution to the ecclesia or your commitment to God or whatever it is, and we have sat here this week and said, I need to do a better job, I need to go home and re-examine that or refocus my life, God hears those thoughts and he will give you opportunity, likely within days, to see whether or not we will respond to those thoughts. And whether or not those thoughts just have a life here in these chairs, or whether or not those thoughts will be strong enough by faith to change our walk, to change our character. What Mordecai and the nation experienced in chapter 4 is now being brought upon Haman. He hurries home with his head covered in mourning. Mordecai had refused to bow down to him, had refused to worship him. The prince of this world is now being judged and is about to be cast out. It's a rhetorical statement in verse 13 of chapter 6, when his wife says, and his friends, if Mordecai before whom you have begun to fall is a Jew, they already knew he was a Jew. They already knew the Jews were special people. They already knew the Jews had a special God. This is the Persian court. They knew about Daniel. They knew and could see that the hand of God was now at work in this situation. And once more, God's hand moves in precise timing, because while they were yet talking, Haman is called away in haste by the king's eunuchs. It's time for Esther's second banquet. She had put a space by faith between the first and second banquet, and she had pleaded with God to intervene, and God had wrought a miracle in that space between the two banquets. Haman's downfall was now guaranteed before the second banquet even begins. And the marvel, as we say, of the hand of providence at work, as the king has already made up his mind over who he's going to select when the option is presented to him. Because at this second banquet, he has to make a decision. Do I side with Haman, or do I side with Esther? And God has already helped him come to the right conclusion. We can imagine the encouragement Esther would feel going into the second banquet. The setting for the second banquet is ideal. If you're now going to make a charge of treason against the prime minister, you couldn't have asked for a better setting than what God had provided. On section 49 of the notes, we won't go through them, but you can see the parallels between the path that Mordecai took in standing up to Haman and the path that Esther takes in standing up to Haman. She didn't know the outcome back in chapter 4, but she had come to realize living one's life under Haman's domination is not what life is about. And brethren and sisters, every disciple must come to this same point of understanding. We must come to the point where we realize, I am not going to allow Haman's influence in my life to dominate how I live. It's not going to dominate how I talk. It's not going to dominate how I treat my spouse and my kids. It's not how I'm going to dominate my conduct at work or in the ecclesia or with my neighbors. It's not going to dominate how I make my plans. It's not going to dominate how I think about myself. But each of us must come to see Haman in that light and do the very same thing to that Haman-like spirit that we see at work in our flesh, and that we see at work in the world around us, where we publicly declare, I will no longer go through life dominated by sin, living for its pleasures, with sin as my master. But that's a decision, brethren and sisters, that each person has to make for themselves. Mordecai could make that decision for himself, but he couldn't make it for Esther. A husband can make that decision for himself, he can't make it for his wife. A wife can make that decision for herself, she can't make it for her husband. And they can't make it for their children. They can show their children and teach their children about the need to make that decision. But each person has to come to that own decision openly and willingly and prayerfully and by faith, declaring their opposition to sin. Standing up to Haman, standing up to sin, is a vital step in the redemption process. In verse 4 of chapter 7, Esther will expose evil Haman. Reading from the RSV, for we are sold, she tells the king, I and my people, to be destroyed and to be slain and to be annihilated or perish. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace. But our affliction is not to be compared or contravened the loss of the king. If it was just about slavery, I would have remained quiet. But Haman has passed a death sentence upon him. She hasn't exposed Haman yet. In verse 5, the king makes inquiry. Who is responsible for this awful situation? Who durst presume in his heart to do this? And the Hebrew would support a much stronger rendering of who is this monster that is looking to put you and your people to death? And Esther responds in verse 6 and says, it is Haman, the enemy and adversary. Sisters, take note, especially. This quiet, gentle spirit of 1 Peter 3 does not meekly sit back and let sin rule her life. There is nothing meek and mild and quiet about what Esther does that day. She is not in hysterics in pleading before the king, but she is firm in her conviction when she makes the accusation that he is the enemy of my people. He asks for the power to destroy my people. And king, you need to know about this situation. She possessed a strong conviction, an absolute boldness. There are no tears recorded. You see, you don't shed tears over the destruction of wickedness. You don't shed tears over Haman's destruction. The tears will come later when she appeals to the king to help save her people, but not in the death of Haman. And we need to have a clear picture of this when she makes her appeal to the king. She's actually reclining on a couch when she makes her charge. Haman had been brought down by Mordecai the day before, and now Esther will bring him down, rather that morning, and Esther will do the same in the banquet that evening. The strength of Haman's character and the strength of his plot lay in his deceit. With the truth exposed, he is immediately terrified, and the king and the queen stand united. The king has a choice to make between the two characters, Haman or Esther, and it is not her female charm that endears her to the king. It's her character. It's her integrity. It's her honesty. This man seeks to put me and all my people to death. And the king can't believe that anyone would want to put Esther and Mordecai and people like that to death. That is treason. That is disloyal behavior. The details recorded about Haman's downfall are not accidental. You trace through what happens in that second banquet, and there is a picture of sin on its way down. He will appeal to Esther. In verse 6, it says he is fearful for his life. He's begging before her to spare her. And in an ironic spiritual twist, but once again a very fitting one, Haman is now pleading with Esther to save his life. He needs a Jew to intervene with the king on his behalf, because Esther has pronounced a death sentence against him, and he knows it. And if she doesn't change her mind, he's a dead man. And the king goes out, and there is Haman pleading with her. The king comes back in, and he says, will he force her in my presence? It is not a physical forcing that Haman is doing. The word means to tread down, to subdue, to bring into bondage. You see it in Nehemiah 5, verse 5. What Haman is pleading with Esther to do is to change her mind. Please, Esther, please change your mind and let me live. And this faithful young sister looks sin square in the eye, or however she did it, and says, I will not change my mind about your destruction. Because, brethren and sisters, sin will plead with us. Don't set such high standards in your life. Don't make holiness the barometer by which you measure your actions. Surely there must be some provision to have some fun along the way and give ourselves over to some kinds of pleasures. And Esther says, not at all. Haman is taken out and he's hung on the gallows in his house. Sin is put to death in its own arena. Because you don't spare Haman, just as you don't spare Agag. They are fit only to be put to death. And therein is the contrast of the faith and understanding and obedience of this remarkable young woman set in contrast to her forefather, King Saul. In this simple yet powerful scene, God is teaching us all that sin will be cast down before those who stand up to it, not only in his son, but in all who are under the death sentence that has been issued, all who learn to take up their cross as Esther did, who don't give in to its pleadings, who won't be subdued by it, who refuse its pleas. We need to take that mental picture with us, brothers and sisters, of mighty Haman, proud and boastful Haman, who wanted all the world to tremble before him. He is now the one trembling, begging for his life at Esther's feet. And we need to believe with all our heart that God can accomplish the same thing in our life if we will commit ourselves to Haman's defeat in our life. Now, hopefully, we've been able to see that the representation of Haman is portrayed in this account of the book of Esther. When we're talking about Haman, we're not talking about some outside influence. We're not talking about someone else. Haman lives in each of us. All of the characteristics, and we've identified them for you on one of the later sections, the selfishness, the arrogance, the egotistical outlook, the blatant disregard for how our actions can hurt others, the tendency and the ease for vengefulness and holding a grudge, the cunning and deception, all of it. There's a Haman that sits in every seat in this room, and there's a Haman that stands at this lectern. That's the lesson for us, one of the lessons in the book of Esther, and we need to commit ourselves to putting that to death. And the way we commit ourselves is to follow the same steps as Esther followed. Because as Mordecai stood up to sin in chapter 3, and Esther then learns to stand up to sin in chapter 4, the community will stand up to sin as the later chapters unfold. And we see an entire community unified in its efforts to put down this evil influence. Because when the Lord Jesus Christ died on the cross, the battle didn't end. Every one of the faithful sons and daughters must take up that same battle. But if we do, and we follow this example, God has shown us that he can break sin's hold over us. Haman can be defeated in our life. He doesn't need to be our master. We don't need to fear and tremble before him. We may have been born one of his seed, but we can be redeemed from his ways. What a marvelous hope God has provided for us by delivering us from the sentence of death that Haman has brought into our life. And may each of us embrace that hope and devote ourselves wholly and fully to the way of life that it calls us to, so that in that day when Christ reigns in Zion and the earth has been subdued, we can join with Esther and Mordecai and the other faithful men and women of that day and celebrate our deliverance together from the power of Haman.